From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, why is it so hard to agree on how to fund Michigan schools?
In Michigan, you know how much it costs to lay a road per mile, but we don't know how much it costs to educate children per student.
Plus, what does or doesn't happen when a gay female athlete comes out?
The glass ceiling in sport was kind of like a glass closet where female athletes were out in some sports, but not others.
After our record cold winter, what can we expect from summer?
What seems to be happening is just a slow progression of warming.
And perhaps a cooler than normal summer season. And we learn about the department store tycoon who turned Kalamazoo into a piano mecca. Those stories and more for you today. It has been 20 years since Michigan passed Proposal A, the then new system for school funding. But two decades on, there's plenty of agreement that Prop A needs to be overhauled. Today on Stateside, we look at the ways to reform K-12 education spending in Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Also this hour, after our bitter, bitter winter, why we should probably expect a cooler summer. But first, stop employment discrimination against gays. That's the challenge coming from the Business Leaders for Michigan. As part of its 2014 Michigan Turnaround Plan, this group is challenging Michigan leaders to pass an anti-discrimination law that includes protection for LGBT workers, something the state's current Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act does not provide. We're joined now by the president and the CEO of the Business Leaders for Michigan, Doug Rothwell. Welcome to Stateside.
Great to talk to you, Cynthia.
Well, we've heard from other voices that Michigan is indeed hurting itself by failing to recognize the lack of civil rights protection for LGBT persons. Why did the Business Leaders for Michigan decide it was time to add its voice?
Well, first of all, Cynthia, we have a goal of making Michigan a top 10 state, and we developed a very holistic strategy towards doing that based on really benchmarking ourselves to the other places around the country that are top 10. And one of the things that we find is that we want to make sure that we can grow our population. Population growth strongly correlates to economic growth. And therefore, we feel that, you know, one of Michigan's challenges is that we've not been growing as a state over this last decade or so. In fact, for a while, we were actually losing population. So one of the recommendations we make in the latest iteration of our turnaround plan is the importance of this. But we look at it from a number of perspectives. For example, we think immigration reform is very important because we think attracting skilled immigrants to Michigan can be a big boost to the economy. We also think that attracting more out-of-state students to come to school here will be important because many of them will stay when they graduate. But obviously, we also think that discrimination in the workplace is bad, and we're against it in all its forms. And that's why we cited that also, we think, as being important to making Michigan positioned as a place that's very welcoming.
Your turnaround plan, as you mentioned, Doug Rothwell, recommends attracting skilled immigrants. And we've certainly heard Governor Snyder out at the forefront of that. But it seems he deflects the LGBT rights issue by saying that he's remaining focused on jobs. Don't you think jobs and gay rights are issues that are connected?
Well, again, we really looked at this in a very broad way, and I think that to single out any one issue of our turnaround plan as being somehow more important than another is probably not what we intended. I think that what we are trying to do is simply reflect the fact that there are a lot of issues that go into growing an economy, and but yet this is certainly part of it. And I think that the governor has to obviously, he's very focused on trying to grow the Michigan economy as well. We're very supportive of his work to attract skilled immigrants to the state. We think that's a very big part of it. But again, we tried to cite not just the issue of discrimination and immigration, but also out-of-state students and other ways that we can grow our population here in our state. Again, without growing population, it's going to be very hard to get the type and level of economic growth that we think Michiganders want.
Do you think the political will is there now, especially kind of feeling the tide turn? We saw what happened with Judge Friedman's decision in federal court on gay marriage, and it just the tide turning. We saw couples lining up to get married while that brief window was open. With that in mind, is the political will beginning to turn, especially when the likes of the business leaders from Michigan are adding their voice?
Well, I think that there's a couple different issues at work here, Cynthia. I mean, I think gay marriage is a different issue. I think that it gets more involved in, you know, kind of a social contract and one that, you know, we did not speak to because we don't really think it's our place to speak to that. You know, our focus as employers is on, you know, making sure that we have an environment in Michigan where discrimination is not tolerated mm-hmm. in any form. And I think that, you know, to answer your question, I think that there is broad support and already has been in the business community, at least among our members, for making sure that we don't discriminate because we think it's important, you know, not just, you know, to grow population, but it's the right thing to do. So, you know, that's probably, I guess, the best answer I can give you to that. But I think that it's really important for us today to be able to, you know, embrace the fact that, you know, discrimination should not be tolerated.
Doug Rothwell is president and the CEO of Business Leaders for Michigan. Thank you so much for talking with us today on Stateside.
You're welcome.
And you can find out more about Michigan's Elliott Larson Civil Rights Act and the push by some to add LGBT rights to it. Just head online. You'll find a link at MichiganRadio.org to Michigan Radio's recent documentary, Unequal by Law, by investigative reporter Lester Graham. Again, it's on the website, MichiganRadio.org. It feels like we have finally emerged from the record-setting cold weather, doesn't it? We hope. Well, as we look ahead to what's left of spring and on to summer, what's in store? Mark Torregrossa is MLive meteorologist, and he's with FarmerWeather.com. Mark, it seems that at least so far, spring has kind of been on the cool and wet side. Please do not tell us that we're going to jump from this straight into the 80s and pushing 90 and not get our lovely Michigan spring in the 70s.
I don't think we're going to see that jump this year. What seems to be happening is just a slow progression of warming, which a lot of us may not be digging after the really cold winter. So I would say, you know, this week we've got a lot of temperatures in the upper 50s to mid 60s. And then next week, probably about 5 degrees warmer on average. And then the week after that, about 5 degrees warmer. So we are going to get spring. It's just, unfortunately, we're going to get it in May and maybe the first week of June.
Well, that's okay.
When we want.
I'm wondering, as we look ahead to summer, does the colder than normal summer follow a whoppingly cool winter? What do past weather patterns tell us?
Well, I looked at three different kinds of weather patterns from the past, and I wrote about this in my MLive blog on MLive.com/weather. There's three ways to look at it. First one, all 5 years that had the same heavy ice cover on the Great Lakes as we did this year,
mm-hmm.
all five following summers were cooler than normal. So 77, 78, 79, 94, 96, all heavy ice years were all cooler than normal in the summer.
Okay.
Also, there were 11 years that had a colder than normal November through March, like we just had.
Mm-hmm.
9 of those years had a cooler than normal summer. One was normal, and one summer was above normal.
All right.
And then the final thing is the ocean right now in the Pacific, tropical Pacific, is in what's called a neutral state. It's not El Nino or La Nina. It is becoming an El Nino very quickly and will by summer. So there were 10 years where we went from neutral state in the winter to El Nino in the summer. And out of those 10, 8 were cooler than normal. One was about normal. One was above normal.
Okay,
so you can kind of see where I'm going.
I do. I kind of see that the data kind of points to cooler than normal. What would that mean? I guess how cool is cool?
Most of those were not cold. They were just a little cooler, and on average, 1.2 degrees cooler than normal, which would mean a very nice, comfortable summer.
But I know there are people out there who love the hot stuff. Will the folks get enough hot days for the beach and pool this summer?
Well, this is the other interesting thing. In all of those cool summers, like, say, for my area and Ann Arbor and much of Michigan's probably mm-hmm. about the same, we get about 90-degree days a year, okay, in a normal summer. In all of those cool years, we still had about 90-degree days.
Okay.
So we could have cooler than normal patterns with small bursts of hot weather. It's a long-range forecast. A lot of the statistics point toward cooler than normal, but I got to tell you, the weather now is so goofy
mm-hmm.
that I would not be surprised to see it go the other way. But the lakes are so cold that it would take a month of very much warmer than normal temperatures to eradicate the cooler than normal water on the Great Lakes. There's a lot of cold stored in there, so it would take a real radical weather pattern change to bring us hot weather.
And as the guy behind FarmerWeather.com, can you offer some do's and don'ts for gardening and planting this spring?
I think if you're looking at a cooler than normal summer, you definitely want to try things that sometimes don't work real well in our hot summers, like spinach, lettuce, peas. Some of those things are real tasty and real healthy. And if we get a year where it goes from winter to summer, they go to seed right away and it's just no good. So I would try that. I think with the cool pockets still up there, we're going to have some frosts into May. So you're probably going to have to do your traditional waiting until Memorial Day to get the warm, loving plants that can't handle any frost in the ground.
All right. Well, you've just saved us some money and time until it gets warmer and we can look ahead to Memorial Day. Mark Torregrossa, MLive and FarmerWeather.com meteorologist. As always, thanks so much, Mark.
You're welcome.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There has been a lot, and I mean a lot, of media attention swirling around Los Angeles Clippers owner Donald Sterling. His racist comments triggered floods of outrage from NBA players and fans and got him bounced out of the NBA. But not too long ago in the world of sports, gay athletes were getting a lot of the attention. Earlier this year, NBA star Jason Collins announced he is gay and became the first openly gay player in the NBA. Then Michael Sam of the University of Missouri came out, and that made him the first publicly gay player on the fast track to the NFL. But they're certainly not the first athletes to come out. There are many female athletes who have done so, but that news makes barely a ripple. PJ McGann specializes in gender, sexuality, and sports at the University of Michigan Sociology Department. She's writing a book right now titled The Ball Fields of Our Hearts, Tomboys, Femininity, and the Gendered Body. So, PJ, why is it less of a thing when a woman in sports comes out than when a man does?
Well, I think actually that there's a number of things going on that intertwine and reinforce each other.
Mm-hmm.
So first off, I think the idea of some female athletes as lesbian fits stereotypes that we have in the dominant culture. Another thing related to that is that if a female athlete is seen as lesbian, lesbian sexuality, some forms of it, is eroticized in the dominant culture, so
we
can kind of contain that potential threat. Related to that, oftentimes women's sports, just like a lot of things that women do, isn't necessarily taken as seriously as the things that men do. So women's sport, there's a lot of different things that show we don't take women's sport as seriously as we take men's sport. And the other thing going on is that it's not just that there isn't homophobia in women's sport, because there is, but it's taking different forms and it plays out differently than it plays out in men's sport.
All right,
I
let's
think.
Start with that.
Okay.
See, there is homophobia, but it plays out differently. So give me an idea what
that
means.
Some ideas about that. Well, one of the things to think about is female athletes are sexualized. Actually, it would be better to say that they're heterosexualized,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of pressure on female athletes to look and appear feminine. A lot of the coverage of women's sports.
Shall we say look and appear hot? Let's talk about marketing.
Yeah, and hot in a straight way.
Yes,
not
hot
in
a straight
not
way.
Not in a hot lipstick, lesbian kind of way.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
Coverage oftentimes will make note of different things that are taken as evidence of her heterosexuality. Like, we'll mention a boyfriend. We'll show pictures of her kids. We'll cut to the supportive husband.
When you think of the recent profiles with the Sochi Olympics, that's absolutely – we saw so much of that. And we didn't see – we really saw nothing about anyone's partner.
Exactly.
We didn't. You're right, now that you put it that way.
Yeah. And there's also an interesting thing, and sometimes it's female athletes choosing it, and sometimes it appears that it's heavenly encouraged by a particular coach or manager, but there's also pressure to appear feminine on the court. I mean, one of the interesting things when you look at even high-powered female athletes, they're competing in full makeup.
I didn't think of that, but there you go.
Yeah. And in, I mean, in some sports, right, you would expect that in figure skating and gymnastics, where the female athletes are being evaluated in part not only on their power and their athleticism, but their grace and their aesthetics.
The look.
But female hockey players. That's a different question. When you look inside the helmet and you see, despite all the sweat, you see full makeup. It's really interesting dynamic.
I'm speaking with PJ McCann of the University of Michigan Sociology Department as we explore gender, sexuality, and sport. And explore the question, why is it when a female athlete comes out, it's nowhere the splash that it is when you have the likes of a Michael Sam of the University of Missouri saying, yes, I am gay. I noticed, dug around, and last year BuzzFeed did an interesting post reminding everybody, hey, female pro athletes have been out for 33 years, starting with Martina Navratilova and Billie Jean King in 1981, and those are certainly two very high-profile athletes. Then the list went through a lot of athletes, say, from the WNBA who've come out. And I have to ask, is the muted reaction more because someone like Jessica Adair of the Minnesota Lynx just is not the name that Jason Collins of the NBA is? And does that just have more to say about how we regard women's athletics?
I think it does, and it's part of how, you know, sport just works for us, right? The way that sport provides powerful images of masculinity that men are supposed to strive for and women are not supposed to strive to be, at least, you know, that aggressive and that physical. So it's interesting that the female athletes who were out first were in some respects outed, right? They didn't necessarily come out on their own. That was certainly the case for Billie Jean King, right? And Martina, it appears Martina was just trying to get ahead of things because there were so many different stereotypes.
So she could control.
Exactly. Pat Griffin used to talk about what she called a glass ceiling. It was kind of like the glass ceiling, you know, in terms of pay or women, you know, getting up to a certain level in terms of executive positions but not being able to break through. And the glass ceiling in sport was kind of like a glass closet where female athletes were out in some sports but not others. And for the longest time, they were out in the individual sports and not the team sports.
That's true. So we would look at women golfers and tennis players. But it took a while before, for example, we had U.S. Olympic soccer athlete who came out.
Right.
So there was a team. But you're right. It was more the individual.
Yeah. And prior to that, the WNBA.
Yes, yes.
But what's interesting is about, you know, one of the players who came out in the WNBA, Cheryl Swoops, was also a model, a mother, and was one of the three athletes that was used to sell the WNBA as this hetero, sexy, family-friendly organization. So it was really interesting when Cheryl eventually came out, and it was mostly a non-event. So the WNBA in particular has seen a huge change in terms of, you know, going from wanting lesbians as part of the audience to but not having an active presence to, yes, we have lesbian athletes on our teams.
Oh, well.
That's the way it is. Of course we do.
When you think that our society is moving towards civil rights and equality for LGBT individuals, like in terms of marriage and work and health care, why is it important for us to pay attention to homophobia in sports?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons. I mean, one, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and trans people have been part of sport since the history of team sport. And they're going to continue to be. And I think we need to have sport be a welcoming place for everybody. But beyond just the individual people who are participating in sport, homophobia in sport is important because of the way that sport works in the popular imagination for us by providing images of gender, but also it provides images and storylines of equality. I mean, one of the things we tell ourselves about sport is that sport is an equal playing field, right? And if that's the case and we start to see more out athletes in sport, it's going to do a couple of things. It's going to challenge our stereotypes, but it's also going to challenge us to live up to the stories we tell ourselves about sport and our society being equal playing fields for everyone.
Dr. P.J. McCann, who's with U of M's Sociology Department. She specializes in gender, sexuality, and sport, and she's currently writing a book called The Ball Fields of Our Hearts, Tomboys, Femininity, and the Gendered Body. Pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you too.
This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. That is pianist Rafal Blahach, who's winner of one of the most prestigious awards in music, the Gilmour Artist Award. This award and the renowned Gilmour International Keyboard Festival all stem from a Kalamazoo man's love of keyboard music. And even though life took him in a somewhat different direction, Irving S. Gilmour managed to turn Kalamazoo into a place that truly celebrates piano music and its artists. The Gilmour International Keyboard Festival is in full swing and runs until May 10th. And it's a pleasure to be joined by Dan Gustin, who is the director of all of this. Dan, so good to have you with us on Stateside.
Thank you, Cindy.
Tell us, if you can, about Irving Gilmour. Before we talk about what his life has brought in terms of the festival, who was this man?
Well, of course, I never met him. He died in 1986, he grew up here in Southwest Michigan, specifically, I think, most of his life in Kalamazoo. And from very early on, he was very interested in the piano. He became very fascinated with the piano as an instrument, took lessons here as a boy, and had the ambition to be a concert pianist. And he went to Yale University, where he went to graduated with a degree in music there, studied piano, and then he went to New York for a couple of years and studied with one of the important teachers in New York. But he decided after that he just didn't have what it takes to make an international career. So he came back here to Southwest Michigan and ran the family department store for almost 50 years.
There is such a story when you think of a young man having such intense dreams and then having to have maybe that internal day of reckoning of saying maybe this isn't going to happen. And that story could end with it all kind of crumbling and going away, but he still kept that love alive, and it lives on in a different way.
He did indeed, and he took that disappointment and made it into something very, very important that endures here in Kalamazoo and in the surrounding area. He was always a man who was dedicated to philanthropy and many different causes, but particularly music and piano music were always at the core of his interests. When he died in 1986, he left the bulk of his fortune to a foundation, which still exists. It's the Gilmour Foundation here, and specified that some of the resources of that foundation were to be used to promote music, pianists, and particularly encourage the younger generation of pianists in the Kalamazoo area. So the trustees, most of whom were financial investors and lawyers and such, they pondered over what to do with this, and they hired a local piano assistant professor at Western Michigan University named David Pocock. And Pocock, after months of traveling and talking to people in the music world, came back and said, what the world doesn't need is another piano competition. There are over 500 in the world today. And, of course, there are some important ones, but most of them not so important. And so he paired the idea of recognizing talent and enhancing career of a worthy pianist with the kind of support and approach that the MacArthur Foundation in Chicago has taken, their so-called Genius Awards, which are chosen by an anonymous panel without the recipient ever knowing that he or she is under consideration. And so that's the way the Gilmour Artist Award and the Young Artist Award that we have perpetuated here with the support of the foundation and local businesses and individuals, that's how it works.
Dan Gustin, tell us about the winners this year. The Gilmour Artist Award winner.
Rafał Blechet is a 27-year-old Polish gentleman who has made a considerable career already at his young age, but primarily in Europe. He's not very well known here. He limits himself to, I think, around 40 concerts a year at this time to grow so that he can grow artistically. Yeah. And he's also working on a degree, an advanced degree in philosophy, in musical aesthetics in Poland. So he's a very interesting individual, but just an absolutely sublime performing artist.
And people will have a chance to attend a concert, I see, on Tuesday, May the 6th.
Yes, that's his recital. And then on the previous Saturday, he will play with the Kalamazoo Symphony, a program consisting of two different concertos, the Beethoven Third Concerto and one of the Mozart concertos. So he's given quite a bit of exposure here.
And about your Young Artist Award winner, who is this?
Well, there are two. The Gilmour Artist Award is given every 4 years. The Gilmour Young Artist Awards, two of them, are given every 2 years. And the festival is biennial also. Mm-hmm. And it's basically, Cindy, the same approach, except that for the young artists, they have to be American citizens or legal residents here in this country, and they have to be under the age of 22. So this is more of an award to encourage a very young person to make a career in music. We have two of them this year, Andrew Hsu and Llewellyn Sanchez-Werner. Both of them, as it happens, are from California.
Huh. You know, Dan, you referenced the family concerts and people can bring their youngsters. And I have to imagine it is a real key challenge to pull in these youngsters and get them in the tent and get them to appreciate keyboard music and get little fingers on keyboards and get them to start performing and playing, particularly as we see schools being forced to dial back in their music education.
It's a great concern, actually. But I think we believe that exposure is the most important thing of all. And with the power and the ubiquity of pop music these days, which we can't escape, it's all around us now, it's our responsibility to introduce kids to concert music in a live performing situation.
Yes.
But the music that they hear nowadays is all electronically reprocessed. Even at a concert, it all comes to them through microphones and speakers and, you know, their various electronic devices that we have today. So presenting a recital of great music in a live performance situation is really what we're aiming for and what it's all about.
Dan Gustin is the director of the Gilmour International Keyboard Festival, running until May 10th. And you can get the full schedule by going to their website, thegilmour.org. Such a pleasure to talk with you, Dan. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure, Cindy.
Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The way Michigan's schools are funded is complex, and the subject is emotionally charged. Proposal A was passed in 1994, a then-new system for funding Michigan schools. Prop A stopped the use of local property taxes as a source of school funding. Instead, it created a new state education tax, and it boosted the state sales tax from 4 to 6 cents on the dollar, with the extra 2 cents going to the school aid fund. Well, here we are, 20 years out, and the one thing many Michiganders agree on, it is time to overhaul Proposal A. But there are so many views on how that should be done. Chastity Pratt-Dossey reports for Bridge Magazine. And this week, Bridge is featuring a series of reports by her looking at how we fund schools in Michigan. Chastity, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So, Chastity, let's get into some history, especially for people who are newer to Michigan or who didn't have kids in school or who were paying property taxes in 1994 when Prop A was passed. So it really wasn't on their radar screens, and we've been living with it for these 20 years. How well did this thing work, and where did it fail?
Well, it did what people wanted it to do. Back in 1994, you had people fed up with their property taxes, just, you know, in some places really getting out of control. So Prop A reduced people's property taxes because it took the onus off of the local property taxpayers to pay for their school districts and spread the payments across the state with a new state education tax. Mm-hmm. So it lowered property taxes, and it, as a result, gave the poorer districts a boost so that they were closer in funding to what the higher funding districts were getting. So those two things it did do. It, you know, it reduced property taxes and it gave more per pupil funding to the poorer district. Well, what it never aspired to do and never has done is totally close the gap between the poor districts and the affluent districts. It didn't totally close the gap. And remember, when you fund schools with 2 cents from your sales tax, what happens when the economy slumps and people aren't really spending a lot of money?
Like it's been, yeah.
Exactly. That means less money for schools. So Prop A makes our schools really, you know, susceptible to the economy and recessions and things of that nature. So for those reasons, people are really saying, well, maybe we need to make some tweaks, make some changes, because we don't want our children to have to suffer when there's some swings in sales taxes and things of that nature.
Which we have certainly watched throughout the Great Recession, which in some areas of the state really felt like a great big depression. So
definitely.
Where your piece for Bridge describes two visions of Michigan in this conversation, or some may say a fight over school funding, equity and adequacy. Spell these visions out for us, Chastity.
Well, when you say equity, you know, people understand it to mean, you know, fairness, equality. Well, you have a camp that says, a group of people in Michigan who say, look, we need to just give every school district a basic per pupil amount that's equal. And then, you know, if you have some poor kids, they'll be eligible for some federal grants. But, you know, start everyone else on the same, you know, playing field with the same state funded per pupil amount. So that's really the most conservative idea of equity. And then you have a group, usually educators, who say, look, we need to fund schools adequately. We need to give each school district enough money to deal with their specific needs. Some schools need more money for transportation, some for special ed. You know, fund them adequately, and then you will have everyone on an equal opportunity playing field. These two camps, two different ways of looking at
yeah.
it, both trying to come up with something that's fair.
And what is the general consensus? What is fair?
Well, we don't really know in Michigan. I had a story that talked about adequacy studies. I would say more than 40 of your states in the United States have done adequacy studies to basically find out how much should a state pay to provide a quality education. Well, Michigan, we're one of the very few who hasn't, you know, done an adequacy study to figure out how much we should be paying for education. So when you say what's fair, we really don't know in Michigan. It's more like we give the schools what the state figures it can afford to give the schools and leave it to them to educate the kids and, you know, spend the money right. Now, I had one source say, well, you know, if in Michigan, you know how much it costs to lay a road per mile, but we don't know how much it costs to educate children per student. And that's just not the case in other states.
And I wonder, as you look at Michigan, and it does seem that there's a basically a general level of dissatisfaction across the board with the gap between the poorer and the more affluent districts, and also Michigan's ability to create and hold on to college graduates. And as we look at that, people were not happy. But then to look out to other states, what can we learn from other states who are doing it better than Michigan?
Well, I think right now everybody talks about Massachusetts and increasingly about Tennessee, where mm-hmm. they've put in a lot of reforms. And what we see in states that are more equitable with their funding and that are, you know, performing better on tests is we've seen them conduct adequacy studies and, as a result, adjust how they fund schools. The study basically says, well, what should we be doing in schools and how much does that cost? Should we be doing year-round school? Should we be doing teacher evaluations? What should we be doing and how much does that cost? And they adjust their funding formulas accordingly. And then they also institute those reforms, and those reforms lead to better outcomes. So in Michigan, we're kind of behind the ball or behind, you know, the trend and need to probably consider some of the avenues that are working in other states.
And is there any appetite or interest in conducting an education adequacy study?
Well, there's a bill, House Bill 5269. Some Democrats are pushing it. It's not really going anywhere right now. But then you also have the State Board of Education, which is raising money to do an independent adequacy study as well. So if I had to guess, I would guess that the State Board is probably going to get their study funded and actually completed before the legislature, because the bill is just not moving right now.
Okay. I also think we need to talk about the fact that we live in a state that has term limits. Do you think that's one of the problems that we face in Michigan in coming up with a good and fair system for funding our schools?
You know, the really tough issues in Michigan rely on legislators who are well-educated on the issues. And, you know, when you term limit people, they don't have 10, 20 years to really intimately know the details. You know, Bill Rogers, who's the he's on the House Appropriations Subcommittee for School Aid, he's been doing this for like 4 budget seasons, and that makes him the most senior person in that capacity. You know, 4 budgets, you know, he's the most senior person. We need really clear understanding, and it's hard for legislators to learn these really intricate details in 6 years and, you know, 4 or 5 budget cycles. So there is consensus, or there is, you know, an opinion out there that term limits really stall the process, because, you know, a legislator could learn the issue and then, you know, they're gone and someone else has to take up, you know, the torch. And it took 20 years to redo our funding system here in Michigan, and that was with legislators who didn't have term limits.
Mm-hmm.
So unless and until there's really a groundswell of voters and taxpayers really begging for change, it's gonna be a hard sell.
Chastity, do you see a way for these very sometimes opposing views about our schools to ever become one vision for funding and improving Michigan schools?
The divisions are deep, and as far as, like, you know, what the Republicans want, what the Democrats want, what the conservatives want, what the school choice people want, what the unions want, these divisions are really deep. And when we got Proposal A, it was really, you know, it revolutionized how we did things in Michigan, but it was led by taxpayers, by voters, by everyday people really pushing their lawmakers to do something. And it was, you know, it was almost a crisis point. We had Kalkaska Public Schools running out of money, you know, literally running out of money. So when we get to the real crisis point, we might see some really quick answers. But I don't know. It's hard to say right now whether we're at a point where we're going to see the real hard conversations happening.
Chastity Pratt Dossie's series, Exploring School Funding in Michigan, can be easily found at the Bridge Magazine website. You can go to bridgemi.com. That's bridgemi.com. Chastity, it has been great talking with you. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Anytime.
Should money from a national tobacco settlement go toward fighting tobacco use and bettering our health in Michigan? Or should the state be raiding that tobacco settlement piggy bank to help save works from the Detroit Institute of Arts and help the city of Detroit retirees? That's the question my next guest addressed in a recent story for the Detroit News. Gary Heinlein, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
So remind us again, Gary, just what this tobacco master settlement agreement is all about.
Well, the settlement was reached in 1998. It originally involved the four largest tobacco companies in the country. Something like 41 other companies subsequently signed on. But the settlement was theoretically to reimburse states for their costs with regard to the health care issues that were created by smoking, people who contracted diseases that are commonly associated with tobacco use, cancers, heart disease, strokes. And the settlement was to compensating the states was also to theoretically or to indemnify the tobacco companies against further litigation. There was a lot of litigation that built up during the 90s as the health effects of tobacco use became more and more firmly documented.
So how much money does Michigan get every year from the Tobacco Master Settlement Agreement?
So Michigan's amounts from year to year have ranged from 250 to 300 million. That's mostly a product of tobacco sales from year to year.
And was it designated how that money was to be used, or was it a gentleman's agreement in a sense?
Well, there were two parts to the settlement. Originally, the tobacco companies and the attorneys general had sought action by Congress, and if Congress had acted on this settlement, the Congress was going to pass regulations under which a portion of the money would be used to prevent kids from smoking. But Congress never was able to come to an agreement, so the settlement was reached independently of Congress with the tobacco companies. And the settlement that was reached did not contain that provision.
So Michigan's legally not bound to use that money for anti-smoking efforts or to treat tobacco-related diseases?
Correct.
So how has the money actually been used since it started coming in 1998?
Well, the state, like most other states, has used it for a variety of purposes to help with state expenses. We've used it for scholarships for worthy high school students for a while under Governor Granholm. It was used as part of the budget settlement one year. More recently, if you look at the money that was spent over this last year, part of it goes for bonds, to secure bonds. Part of it goes to what's called the 21st Century Jobs Fund. It's used for emerging industries, high-tech industries mostly. And then part of it does go to Medicaid, but not specifically for anti-smoking efforts.
And Governor Snyder has his eye on some of that money to use in this so-called grand bargain that came out of Detroit's bankruptcy.
Correct. He wants to use $350 million at a rate of $17.5 million a year. That would be used as part of a deal to partially protect Detroit retirees from the effects of the bankruptcy.
Sure.
And also to help the city avoid having to sell off city-owned DIA, Detroit Institute of Arts, masterpieces.
Meantime, anti-smoking groups, groups like the American Cancer Society, are clearly not happy with that money not going to fight cigarette use. I know the American Cancer Society, someone from their Michigan division said, we've not had a legislature that's really been willing to invest in prevention for at least the last 15 years. So this is certainly something that predates the Detroit bankruptcy.
Yes, that's true. Going back to the original settlement and the argument that was made that part of the money should be used for tobacco or smoking prevention, that idea still persists among the various health industry groups or the various health-related groups.
And I saw that the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids finds that Michigan ranks 42nd in the nation for how much tobacco settlement money is actually spent fighting tobacco smoking. And I'm wondering if we have any idea if the states that rank high, like Alaska being number one, so they use a lot of that money for anti-smoking, has it resulted in a big decrease in smoking and smoking-related illnesses? Did it really make a dent?
Well, it's made a small dent.
But one might have to ask, especially with the conditions the way they've been in Michigan during the recession, might that money be better used to help, you know, soften the blow for Detroit's pensioners or to help struggling school districts or provide scholarships?
Well, that's the argument that I think that Governor Snyder's administration would make, that the state really needs the money. And that's been true through the years. I mean, we were in a 10-year recession.
Yeah.
So we needed money from wherever we could get it. So we used the tobacco settlement money, of course, as part of the deal. But in the meantime, the Centers for Disease Control says to run an effective campaign here in Michigan, we ought to be spending perhaps $110 million a year on advertising and smoking cessation efforts to convince teenagers not to smoke and to help adults, smokers, to quit.
And I see we spent $1.8 million annually. We have a long way to go.
We're way below that. We've done a little better at times in the past, but that's pretty much been the level at which we've funded it up to this point.
Gary Heinlein, reporter for the Detroit News. Gary, thank you so much for talking with us and kind of reminding everybody what's happening with that tobacco money.
Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattelsey, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Omar Sadeh, Claire Tennisketter, and Jeff Warniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.